Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what does the retirement of Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy mean for the United States? And first, what's behind the rise in suicides? Joining us now is Mark Kaplan. He's professor of social welfare at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. His publications include The Social Nature of Male Suicide, A New Analytic Model, Suicide Among Male Veterans, A Prospective Population-Based Study, and Physical Illness, Functional Limitations, and Suicide Risk. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much for being with us, Mark Kaplan. It's great to have you with us. We wanted to do this segment partly because there has been some evidence, some reports that the suicide rates are going up in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to start to understand what are the factors that explain the rise in suicide rates and what this really means for a society. So why don't we start with what explains the rise, for example, in the CDC report that says these deaths have risen since 2005, something like more than half don't know they have mental health disorders.
The data they reported were not entirely new. I mean, we knew the rates were on the rise. What surprised a lot of people were the additional information that was also reported at the time. Not only did they report trends based on a particular database that they have, but they also reported new findings, or relatively new findings, from something called the National Violent Death Reporting System, which was quite interesting and which got far less attention than the rate on the rise since 1999. Namely, the National Violent Death Reporting System, which I have been funded to study that data set, showed that, which is quite interesting, that is that there are a number of suicide decedents who do not follow the standard, who do not have the standard psychiatric profile associated with suicidality, that perhaps psychopathology is not present. So there were some additional findings that one needs to look at in order to fully understand the changing nature of suicide in this country. It is indeed going up, but it's not going up in all groups at the same rate. One needs to disaggregate, so to speak, and look at certain groups that seem to be more vulnerable, that is, people in their middle years, men in their middle years in particular, men in their 45 to 64, which has been getting quite a bit of attention based on work that the two economists, Case and Deaton, showed a couple of years ago, the rise in, that's the group that's experienced the most dramatic rise in suicide in the United States.
So traditionally, has suicide been more prevalent in one gender than the other, or?
Yes.
So yes. Historically, how has it been versus?
Well, there are very few, globally speaking, there are very few countries. In fact, we all know of one country, that is China, where the rate of suicide is higher among women than men. Outside of China, most countries pretty much follow the same patterns. Let's focus on the United States for a moment. And these are the most recent statistics from the CDC, namely 2016. And there were about 45,000 deaths overall in the country. Out of those 45,000, about 35,000 were males, and about just a little bit over 10,000 were females. The rate, the ratio of men to women is about 3 to 4 to 1, depending on which age, too. That's for every age group. But in older people, that is older than 65, men are 12 times, have a rate of suicide that is 12 times higher than their female counterparts. So there's this variability across the board. Some have said that there's a gender paradox in the sense that women are more likely to attempt, and that is true based on the data, and men are more likely to complete and die by suicide, partly due to the methods that men use. More men who die by suicide attempt suicide with a die of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Women are more likely to use less lethal means, that is, means with a lower case fatality rate. But that's also changing. I have one of my PhD students is looking at changing patterns or trends in gun suicide among women, and those rates are on the rise, and about a third of all deaths, suicide deaths among women involve guns.
So let's talk about why some of these trends are shifting a little bit. Mm-hmm. I understand there are some economic factors, there are some social factors, as well as psychological ones. Can you mm-hmm. divide these up and help us understand what each of these seems to be?
What perhaps you might best refer to is the psychosocial influences on the suicide rate. And for one, there are demographic factors. There are geographic factors. There are cultural factors. Case in point, I recently was having this conversation about Korea. Korea today, unlike the past, has the highest, one of the highest suicide rates, according to the OECD. Some have tried to look at that problem as purely psychological. But I think that misses the point. There are major cultural changes, religious changes, from religions of the past to the religions of the present, towards a more Christian, towards Christianity. So there are a lot of changes occurring at the national level in Korea that might be contributing to the shifts in the suicide rate. In the United States, I was funded by the National Institute of Health, NIH, to study specifically the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, to study the effects of the Great Recession of 10 years ago. And I think there's some interesting findings there that are relevant in terms of the social determinants of suicide. Namely, at the time of the recession, that is end of 2007, December officially starting December 2007, and lasting or ending in June of 2009, we studied using a natural experiment design. In other words, we looked at data before the recession, during the recession, and after the recession. And what we found was the following. Men, the rate of suicide did go up. The rate of alcohol-associated, that is, men who died by suicide had alcohol on board, had consumed alcohol, and in many cases were intoxicated. That also went up, which might be a marker of impulsivity. And also what's interesting, and perhaps the most surprising finding for us, and we published these a couple years ago, was the fact that there was a lag effect, a delayed effect for women. So women who were subjected to the Great Recession had a rise in their suicide rate and a rise in their alcohol-linked suicide rate a few years after the men. So there was a delayed effect in the delayed adverse effects of the Great Recession on women.
So what does this tell us in terms of economics? I mean, I'm assuming that while we've got this trend shifting when we have a Great Recession, so there's economic pressure on people, obviously not everybody commits suicide. And so there must be a combination of more than one factor, right? So mm-hmm. we've got the Absolutely. Economic factors coming in, and some people are more susceptible than others.
Absolutely.
What is that?
Yes. That's always an important question. Why, you know, we often focus on those who die and focus on, if you will, the negatives. But what about the positives? What about those who were resilient, who were capable, had the capacity to weather, you know, it could be host resistance, what epidemiologists called host resistance, could be a combination of biological factors, genetic constitution, psychological constitution, social supports. They had protections. They had folks to lean on. But there are many individuals who did not weather the adversities of the economic recession. That is, people and when you look, when you dig a little bit deeper and you drill down a little bit, what you see during the Great Recession was that those who were had fewer years of education had a much higher rate. Those in a lower socioeconomic position to start with were more likely to have a much higher unemployment rate. You know, the unemployment rate varied according to one's education level. Education, to some extent, is destiny as a socioeconomic factor. But in terms of the Great Recession, those with a graduate degree, at least 4 years of college plus maybe a few years of graduate school, had a unemployment rate that was 4%, if not under that. Those with just a high school or less had nearly 12%, even higher rates in some cases. And there was some geographic variability, too. So to add to this mix of psychological vulnerability, gender, genetic, also geographic, they're really critical differences, at least in the United States, according to where you live. If you live on the West Coast, the suicide rates are lower. On the East Coast, northeast part of the country, they're lower. In the middle, they're higher. Between the Mississippi and the mountain region, and that's the area with the highest suicide rate. And then on top of all this, and I did allude to this early on, the role of guns in all this, because in the case of men, over 60% of men who die by suicide do so with a gun. With women, it's about a third.
So it does raise a lot of questions. And one of those questions related to guns is whether that rate of dying by guns, if suicide should be considered on par with homicide. As an expert on suicide, what would you say on this?
That's an important question, because the debate surrounding, and I'm interested in firearm violence as well. I teach a course at UCLA on firearm violence, and I'm very interested in firearm violence, not only as it pertains to suicide, but in general. Two-thirds of all, I'll give you the figures, about 34% of gun deaths in this country are homicides, about 62% are suicides. So the lion's share of gun deaths in this country are suicides, but the debate about gun control has been confined in many ways to homicides and maybe accidental deaths. There's been far less attention. It's almost as if it's a hidden epidemic, if you will, of gun suicides. I don't quite understand why. I think it has some cultural explanations. I think there's certain, you know, it might have something to do with the stigma of mental illness, as well as, people who might have a mental health issue who are perhaps suicidal and have access to guns. That's a debate that we haven't had in this country. So I am always concerned that the discussion, both at in the press and the media, as well as at the policymaking level, have focused away from suicides involving guns. And let me just give you an example. According to the data on which states have the most restrictive gun laws, when you look at California gets an A+ from the Brady Giffords organizations on in terms of restrictiveness, gun restrictiveness. Compared to the rest of the country, California, when you look at the rest of the country and you look at certain age groups, nearly 50, 60% of the suicides involve guns. In California, it's 30% or under. So restrictive gun laws do matter in terms of reducing the likelihood of gun use among suicidal individuals.
And then the other factor that you have pointed to in your work is about poverty and the role of poverty.
Exactly.
So
right.
Let's talk about poverty and why it's a role. And that trajectory doesn't, of course, explain when wealthy people commit suicide, but it sounds like what you're saying is that more poor people commit suicide than wealthy people.
Here's an interesting point about that, is that there's just so much that we don't know about suicide, and we're lumping a lot of heterogeneous factors. Suicides, the types of, for one, have always said that, when we look at suicide mortality or suicide morbidity, that we need to separate genders. I mean, the phenomenon of suicide among women is quite different from the phenomenon of suicide among men. Men are more likely to die. Women are more likely to survive after an attempt. And the question of the socioeconomic determinants, I think that's a different type of suicide than the type of suicide that we often think of, the recent deaths of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain kind of highlighted, the white, that perhaps well-educated white individuals are most vulnerable. Well, that is true to some extent, but there are a lot of hidden suicides. There's suicidal behavior that doesn't necessarily lead to death, but is clearly a form of self-harm that's associated with one's socioeconomic position, one's disadvantage. Poverty emerged as a factor in one of the last studies we did under this grant was to try to disentangle the different determinants during the Great Recession. We looked at unemployment. We looked at home foreclosures, which was one of the markers, right, of the Great Recession. When you take a look at any pictures, you'll see signs everywhere around the country for foreclosed homes. And then we also looked at the rate of poverty. And what really stood out, which was a surprising finding, what above everything else, it was poverty that seemed to be driving up the suicide rate and the alcohol-linked suicide rate.
Are there certain common factors that we can point to psychologically that merge with these social factors, like certain emotions? And I ask this partly because of things like anxiety and shame. And I guess it was a week ago, we did a program on healing trauma in people who have experienced trauma. And we talked about emotions like shame and how hard it is to heal somebody who has persistent shame. Are these emotions something that are important common ground that go with the social factors?
They do, but they should not be stripped away from their social context. And that is depression. There are social determinants of depression. When one loses a job, one becomes demoralized. One becomes, you know, begins to feel those negative emotions that may contribute to a trajectory leading up to a suicide attempt. So what concerns me is that we tend to individualize, if you will, or over-psychologize the phenomenon of suicide. You know, many people have said, folks in the profession of, you know, studying suicide have said that, you know, suicide should not be, is not the exclusive domain of the psychological sciences. That we need to look at, if there's one thing we learn from Durkheim, writing in the late 1800s, who is still relevant today, major shifts, societal shifts, the way society is organized, all contribute to a rise in suicide. And that to do anything less than examine those social forces, I think we do ourselves an injustice by failing to look at the broader, the more distal determinants of suicidal behavior.
So one of the factors, so I'm a political scientist, and so I'm always curious about the politics of all of this. And one of the politics I would imagine is the politics of healthcare.
Yeah.
And where that might come into play. So, for example, we do get messages societally about how we should be able to heal ourselves, right? We've got plenty of self-help books and gurus and life coaches. And
but it's often heal thyself.
Yes, it's often heal thyself. And it happens to be expensive.
Of course, but the issue of personal responsibility is creeping back. As you know, we are attaching all sorts of conditions to receiving welfare, so to speak, whether it is health care, whether it is food stamps, whether it is you name it. We are putting the onus, that's the result of a conservative wave. That is the imposition of responsibility on the individual, as opposed to assuming a more socially just approach, which is an emphasis on collective responsibility. We're not quite there yet. Let me give you an example of during the time we were studying the Great Recession, I had some interactions with colleagues in Sweden. I spent my last Fulbright in Sweden, and I established some close relationships, and I went back to them after we started our project, and I said, did you guys experience the rise in suicide that we did? And there was a pause there, and he said, "No, not at all. We didn't. Nothing really changed that much. The reason for that is that they stepped in, and that safety net was strengthened. In other words, workmen's compensation, unemployment compensation, everything that we've wrapped around people at times, all those services were there, and the state stepped in, and there was a collective response to it, and they softened the blow of the global financial crisis in Sweden. We basically lowered the safety net and allowed people to fall. Many of them fell and wound up taking their own lives."
So I imagine a big part of this is also that sort of social stigma that you sort of alluded to in this whole conversation sort of falling down and not having the ability to pick oneself up and also the stigma that gets attached.
Exactly. Well, you're talking about multiple barriers here. One is the stigma. I mean, there's no doubt, you know, we've tried for years to establish parity between mental health and physical health. We're nowhere close to that. I mean, no one will tell you with a straight face that we have achieved parity in terms of treating the two where there's no stigma. As you know, there are many people who walk around who have kept silent about their distress. And there are a lot of people distressed. It's not just depression. There are probably more people who are distressed out there but are unable, unwilling to discuss their feelings.
Now, do you think that there are a chunk of people in this percentage that have no known mental illness that are actually suffering from a mental illness?
The bottom line is that we don't know. Let me take you back to something early on. You know, we don't even know how many people die by suicide every year, believe it or not. The 45,000 people approximately who died in 2016 is probably an underestimate. I have colleagues of mine in West Virginia, Professor Ian Rocket and Professor Eric Kane at Rochester, who published a piece in one of the JAMA journals a few years ago, and they noted that unlike the official statistic of suicide being the 10th leading cause of death, they argue that if we really took into account, you know, many of these deaths that are due to drug intoxication that look very much like suicides, our rate of suicide would probably be rank 8th, not 10th. So, and years ago, the Institute of Medicine in their 2002 report, Reducing Suicide, a National Imperative, argued that our rates are probably, the true rate is probably 25% higher. And let me tell you something else which we have uncovered, and this is somewhat exploratory analysis, but it is very informative, and that is there are lots of silent suicides. You know, people who do not have the standard markers of standard psychiatric markers of suicidal behavior, that is, don't have a history of depression, don't have a problem with substance abuse, all those things that we often attribute, all those risk factors that we often aim our efforts at. In the analysis we did, there were about 22%, in the database we had, about 22% of the men were basically men without any of these markers, these standard factors that we often say are contributors to suicide.
Now, there's something else that people have questioned, and that is this role of sort of copycat whenever it's in the media. Is that a real phenomenon, or is that just people being afraid?
Well, I was interviewed after the one of the recent deaths by a celebrity. I was interviewed by after each one of them, but one of them, you know, because this came up shortly after that, I think it was Robin Williams, right? There was a lot of concern. There was some research that was published, a study that came out that said there were some deaths attributed to him. There's pretty strong evidence based on the World Health Organization that there is some evidence that a death of a celebrity can trigger some other suicide. There's no doubt about it. But the question is, were these individuals already vulnerable? Did somebody go from no vulnerability at all, zero vulnerability, to becoming vulnerable enough to take their own lives? There are questions that we simply don't know. There's an inability, I think, in the field to truly embrace complexity. And suicide, to me, is one of the most complex public health problems that I ever looked at, and I'm a public health researcher.
Yeah, you must think that in order for somebody to commit suicide, they must be in so much pain that staying alive is not an option.
Oh, absolutely. One of my areas of interest is quality of life, health-related quality of life. And there are people, there are individuals who feel that their condition, they feel worse than dead. That's what they say. So yes, there are people who we might even come across who feel a profound sense are facing some existential crisis and feel a tremendous amount of distress in their lives and don't communicate this. And it's true. It's probably true for men. You know, they're men who don't often like to talk about their emotions. You know, that's probably playing, you know, male psychology is playing some role in why, you know, in explaining why men have a higher rate of death due to suicide.
So I suppose there's a certain amount of compassion that we should probably be really lending to this situation as a society that perhaps we're not giving enough to.
Well, you know, I think if we were a more compassionate society, we would probably devote more of our national resources to the study of suicide. Just case in point, I just happened to look this up the other day, and I was looking at what the National Institutes of Health spend on the and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention spend on the on research involving, you know, studying the epidemiology and the prevention of suicide. You know, we spend this is a couple years back now, about 5 years, 2013. Suicide received $37 million, okay? Heart disease, $1.2 billion. HIV/AIDS, $2.9 billion. Prostate cancer, $266 million. And guess what? HIV/AIDS, the death rate between 2002 and 2013 dropped by 53%. Heart disease, the death rate dropped by 29%. The prostate cancer, the rate dropped by about 14%. Suicide, the rate went up 2003 to 2013 by over 20%.
So do you think that the paucity of funding to understand suicide is coming from our own sort of societal denial?
Well, I think it's a denial. I think there's the historic problem, and this is an ancient problem, of some of the myths, the stereotypes, the stigma of mental illness. I mean, that there's no question about that. But not everybody who takes their life had a diagnosable psychiatric problem. You know, there's a dispute about that. There's a dispute about where that data comes from. If you look at other countries, the role of psychopathology in suicide is a lot less significant of a factor than in the United States. But there's no question, you know, mental health is a big problem. Guns is a big problem, too. You know, the problem of, at least in suicide, most suicides are gun-related. And they're even more gun-related among men. And if we were more serious about the gun debate, we would probably do something about, limiting access to guns among people who are, perhaps suicidal. But not even, you know, there. As I said before, there are people who are not suicidal who have access to gun and wind up taking their own lives. They may have faced, and this is one of the things we found in an earlier study, that sometimes all it takes is a major crisis, some existential crisis that drives people to short circuit some of the standard trajectories that people take when they take their lives and basically go from experiencing a major crisis to ending their lives with a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
So it's probably... The country is probably in a bit of an existential crisis at the moment. States.
I mean, it's almost a state of denial in many ways of the role that guns play in suicide, the magnitude of the problem of suicide, and it's probably even worse than people think. In many age groups, it's the number two or number three leading cause of death. In this country, it's probably the eighth leading cause of death, and yet we devote so few of our national resources, and I think that's a shame, and that's the denial, and that's the lack of collective responsibility for this important, you know, public health crisis.
And so, in terms of where we go from here, if you were going to make one very solid recommendation, would you just say we need to understand this better, so we need to devote more funds to it, or would there be something else?
One obviously approach is to extend funding. For instance, there's a national database called the National Violent Death Reporting System. And the National Violent Death Reporting System, or NVDRS, has been historically underfunded, and it would provide us with some insights. It's a unique database in the industrialized world, and it would provide us with new information on some of the factors associated with suicide deaths. I think we need to spend more money at the national level in terms of prevention at the NIH and CDC and other agencies. That would be helpful. But we also, at a more theoretical conceptual level, I think we need to step back a little bit and widen our lens, or what I would call widening our lens. You know, many of us operate in silos as we study suicide. Most of us do not adopt a truly transdisciplinary approach to suicide. And given the complexity and the more proximal versus distal risk factors involved, I think there's a real need to reconceptualize how we've approached, how we've studied suicide. We need new streams of funding, and we need to have a political will at the national level and at the highest level. I mean, most of our leaders have tried and have been unsuccessful. President Obama tried to expand the NVDRS, tried to do more through the CDC, and, you know, it unfortunately, some of these issues get bogged down because of the gun debate, you know, get caught up in gun politics. And that's a big problem. But, you know, we have had on the books for a long, long time something called the Dickey Amendment, which has basically placed a moratorium on the funding of gun research in this country, as you might know, through the CDC and the NIH. This goes back to the 90s. So we are far behind in understanding the role that guns play in suicide.
Well, Mark Kaplan, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Mark Kaplan, he's professor of social welfare at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. His publications include The Social Nature of Male Suicide, A New Analytic Model, Suicide Among Male Veterans, A Prospective Population-Based Study, and Physical Illness, Functional Limitations, and Suicide Risk. When we come back, Anthony Kennedy's retirement opens big constitutional and political questions for the future of the United States. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Great speculation has arisen about the effects of Justice Anthony Kennedy's resignation, particularly on the rights, liberties, and politics in the United States. Will it ultimately change course in the USA? And does this also illuminate the fundamental flaws in the U.S. politics, in the Supreme Court system itself, and on the Constitution? We have three guests joining us now. Stephen Griffin is a professor of constitutional law at Tulane University. He's the author of American Constitutionalism, From Theory to Politics, Long Wars and the Constitution and Broken Trust, Dysfunctional Government and Constitutional Reform. Sanford Levinson is a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas. He is the author of The Undemocratic Constitution and Nullification and Secession in Modern Constitutional Thought, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. John Weil is a dean and a professor of political science at the Middle Tennessee State University. He is the author of Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, Essential Supreme Court Decisions, and The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution. Welcome to the three of you. It's great to have you back here on the Scholar Circle. We have a momentous event, or at least it's being made out to be a momentous event with the retirement of Anthony Kennedy. So I thought we need to start by talking about really his legacy and who he is. Sandy Levinson, if you were going to encapsulate Anthony Kennedy, who he is and what he has meant for American politics and law, what would you say?
Well, most obviously, he's been the so-called median justice for the last 12 years or so, since Sandra Day O'Connor retired. So practicing lawyers would often pitch their arguments at Anthony Kennedy because he would be the fifth vote in the 5-4 coalition. His legacy, I think, will clearly be with regard to gay rights. He picked that. He was assigned to write the key opinions, and that is what he will be best known for. That is, in part, a principal reason why many people, independently of Donald Trump, why many people lament he's leaving the court. His other legacy, quite frankly, is a certain kind of vaporous style of writing opinions that can drive law professors and practicing lawyers crazy, because it's very difficult to figure out exactly what they mean in terms of applicable doctrine for later cases. So let me stop there.
John Weil?
I don't think I could have said it any better. And I like the way Sandy avoided the term that Justice Kennedy hates, which is to call him the swing justice. Calling the medium or whatever, it fits very well. I think what makes this resignation and appointment fascinating is it's likely to be more consequential than the last. It would have been hard to replace Scalia with someone much more conservative than he was, but while Kennedy probably leaned right in more cases than not, Trump could certainly find somebody who is farther to the right than he is, and therefore would likely have a greater impact on the court than replacing a Scalia with a Gorsuch.
Stephen Griffin.
I would add to Sandy's great comment is that Kennedy was a conservative, important to remember, Californian. And that's where I think some of the gay rights comes from, but with a libertarian bent that produced not only gay rights opinions, but very strong First Amendment opinions, especially the Citizens United case, which is quite well known and decried among liberals. I don't think we should forget that it's not just opinions decided that matter. It's what the court is not necessarily taking up because they may be dominated by conservatives or liberals. And Kennedy was part of a conservative court. I would strongly agree with Sandy that it's not just a style of reasoning that's maybe vaporous, but the content of Kennedy's reasoning may be have a short shelf life because it was so idiosyncratic. I'm not sure anyone views Sandra Day O'Connor, who was mentioned as the last median justice, as leaving a really important doctrinal legacy. And I'm afraid that some of Kennedy's opinions, including the area of gay rights, may not have as long a shelf life as he would last because he pursued courses of reasoning that were very hard for not just law professors, but for lower court judges to understand and thus continue and enforce.
So I understand that Donald Trump really worked hard to persuade Anthony Kennedy to leave, to retire. I wonder now, are we remaking American society and American law really in Trump's image? How can we put this into sort of a broader political and historic context? Is it that big of a thing or is it not? Sandy Levinson?
The idea of Trump's image is mixed. I don't think Donald Trump could care less about abortion. I think he has made a quite reasonable political calculation that his base, on whom he clearly relies, cares deeply about abortion, and he'll give it to him. And the next justice will clearly vote either to minimize or out-and-out overrule Roe versus Wade. Nobody can reasonably believe anything else. And when Donald Trump says that he's not using abortion as a litmus test, as in so many areas, he's simply lying through his teeth. But as I say, I don't think he cares. I think what he does care about is presidential power. And the fact is, Anthony Kennedy turned out to be a reliable vote for what I regard as near dictatorial presidential power in the area of foreign affairs and military policy. And I have no doubt that he will pick somebody who agrees that basically the president can do whatever he wants. I would add one other caveat, though. Law professors or very gifted political scientists like John Vile, you know, love to focus on the court, and the pathology of law professors, more so than political scientists, is to believe that the court is kind of uniquely important in running American life. The fact is that if you want to understand the Trumpification of American politics, you have to look at an absolutely subservient Congress. You have to look at Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. So the important thing the next justice will do is simply rubber stamp whatever the president wants and whatever a Republican Congress is able to pass. And that is the Trumpification of politics. Say, abortion is a sideshow for the base, but I don't think Trump cares.
So one of the things that I've been thinking about since this occurred, and Sandy Levinson, I think you're absolutely right about Anthony Kennedy and who he has been since Donald Trump has been in office. And in fact, the only two places where I think that liberals, liberal lawyers, liberal politicians, liberal political scientists and constituencies can look to Kennedy and say he was kind of moderate were essentially on those social issues like gay rights, for example, right? But
in some areas of criminal justice.
Okay, in some areas of criminal justice. Now, my question today is, given who you mentioned, Mitch McConnell, and whoever replaces Paul Ryan, but really Mitch McConnell, he's really the key here. Given who they are and given what they have done during the Obama administration and not letting him appoint a justice, what stops Donald Trump from appointing a completely unethical justice who doesn't really care about law at all and has a profound effect on elections and democracy itself?
I don't think that's a fair way of putting it, because I think the people on his list, insofar as they know anything about them, are all smart, well-educated, and not unethical. I think the reality of American politics, including American legal politics, is that we're absolutely polarized. So, you know, you don't have to believe that Samuel Alito or Clarence Thomas is unethical in order to believe that they're profoundly wrong and that their vision of the country is really quite ominous. And
I wanted to say something about
what
that
we
one.
Have to do, I think, is talk about ideology rather than about, you know, trying to find unethical behavior in their past. I would be appalled if Amy Barrett were appointed to the court, but I have no doubt that she passes any standard tests with flying colors.
John Vile, was that you wanting to?
No, I think that was Steve. So why don't we let him go ahead, and then I'll pick up.
Okay. Can I just insert one court case into this question? And that is Bush v. Gore. And I'll let you go with that, Stephen Griffin, what you were going to say. But that particular case leads me to question ethics and integrity.
Right. And there's other reasons as well, like the Republican shutdown of the process that led to the Senate not considering Merrick Garland. There's plenty of things to, for the Democrats to be upset about. The fact is that in standard McConnell political terms, the Republicans have played this beautifully, but you're looking at the fulfillment of a very long-term plan. You know, Trump has this list. It's not his list. You know, I don't think Sandy stated that strongly enough. He's catering to the base, but he's catering to the base because it's a very well-organized effort by conservative lawyers to put together a bench of people for whom to select that don't have any particular ethical orientation. They do have a very strong orientation that deserves more exploration, which is many of them believe that the U.S. has been on a bad course as far as not really fulfilling or pursuing the rule of law for a very long time. And Roe versus Wade is one of their top examples of that. And that's why I believe it will come under threat. But let's not believe that, you know, Trump didn't decide to make this list in his image. He rather appropriated a list and an agenda that was already formed for him and has been forming for decades. And this is one of the biggest payoffs ever for that effort that was long running before Trump ever decided to run for president.
John Vile.
Well, let me add, you started with, you know, talking about the Trumpification of the court. And I was going to say, and I'm sort of glad I waited here and listened to some more comments, that Trump has been very lucky in that he has two appointments in his first 2 years, and Obama went 8 years and only got two. But now that I'm listening to the conversation, you know, part of that is because Obama's last nominee was blocked. So it's, you know, it's not completely luck. The other thing that I think I would mention, because I certainly agree with what Sandy said, Sandy and Steve, but Sandy especially, you know, it's not a question of whether these people are ethical or not. It's not likely to be. I mean, the only thing that could subvert, as far as I can tell, the nomination over the next 3 or 4 months would be if, you know, some secret scandal were revealed, or you found out they had a fake law degree, or, you know, something that seems almost incredible. But, you know, we maybe when we remember Bush versus Gore, we should also remember U.S. versus Nixon. And I may need a little help here, because I believe that Nixon had appointed either 4 or 5 of the justices. And if I recall, Rehnquist recused himself, although I may be wrong about that, but all the Nixon appointees who voted in that case voted against Richard Nixon on the issue of executive privilege. And while it is true that conservative justices do tend to be more deferential to presidential powers, I don't think that means that they would necessarily roll over if we had a case where there were a direct subpoena to the president on a matter that seemed to involve criminal wrongdoing. We might very, you know, Trump may very well be surprised. You can appoint somebody to the court, but once they're there, sometimes they grow a backbone if they didn't have one before.
Sandy Levinson, what do you think about that?
I think U.S. Hawaii versus Hawaii is more relevant.
Why?
You know, I think Justice Korematsu, which the court flamboyantly and I think basically dishonestly overruled, can easily be distinguished in lots of ways, so that it was a bone thrown to, you know, to liberals, that with U.S. versus Nixon, at that point, his, you know, popularity, I think, was somewhere in the 20s. It was all about getting access to tapes that would be highly relevant with regard to a cover-up for which there was already lots of independent evidence. And people, I think, were already pleading guilty. So the only question was, in Howard Baker's terms, what the president knew and when he knew it. And when the tapes were finally released, we knew that the answer was basically on June 18th. I don't think that that's likely to be repeated. It could, you know, who knows what Michael Cohen really has on Trump. But what Trump wants to do, and is, you know, being quite successful at it, is really radically revise our immigration policy, radically revise our foreign policy and the like. And that just doesn't raise U.S. versus Nixon sorts of questions. And so I think you have to look at cases like Boumediene, where Kennedy was the fifth vote, to say that non-U.S. nationals confined at Guantanamo had rights. I cannot imagine that a Trump appointee will believe that any non-U.S. nationals, especially if they're not within the United States itself, have any rights that we're bound to respect. And even those who are within the United States, I think their rights are going to be minimized almost to the vanishing point.
I think that's a scary thought. John Vile?
I think that I disagree here, in the sense that, I mean, what I'm referring to is the possibility that the president, that the current president, might try to deny a subpoena that seems to directly go to domestic criminal activity. And I think, you know, I think the court has always gives greater deference in cases like Korematsu. I'm not a fan of U.S. Hawaii by any means. But my hope when that decision came down, and it may show that political scientists are more naive maybe than law professors are.
No.
My hope was that the court was keeping its powder dry. You let the president commend them for recognizing his power, and presumably if there does come a time where it could actually go to criminal wrongdoing, they would have a little bit more credibility in saying, you know, you won a couple, but now you're not going to win this one. I think one of the most disturbing things about President Trump was a comment that he made, you know, very shortly after becoming president, you know, trying to denigrate a judge on the basis of Mexican heritage, which it turns out I don't think he was even born in Mexico. But, you know, I think it's possible that the current justices appointed by Trump or others will keep that in the back of their mind and, they are sworn to uphold the Constitution like the president is, and hopefully there could come a point where if it were needed, they would step in. But, you know, certainly, you know, Sandy is right. You know, if we're expecting salvation from the court, you know, voters better think twice. We have our own obligations here on these matters.
You know, the issues that I was trying to raise in terms of the integrity of democracy and the integrity of elections as well, I guess was partly also in what I've been seeing coming down in the decisions over the last few terms around the issues of electoral integrity and around the issues of, you know, labor unions or whatever the issues are. If they seem to be harming the Republican Party's power base, they seem to be finding the legal reasoning to justify eliminating one more aspect of possibility of Republicans losing power. And that might be a really naive way to look at it. But when I step back, and of course I live in another country now, so I can look at it from far away and go, you know, this looks a little fishy to me. Am I out of my mind, Stephen Griffin?
Yeah, I don't think so. I was kicking myself for not mentioning voting rights. I think if you come at things from a Democratic or liberal perspective, the prospects for voting rights are looking very grim. And this is a court that's already given a pass, also in a decision that's, on voter IDs, it's widely seen as a mistake, but even by the justices who decided it. But still, there's a lot of ferment that's been going on in the lower courts, with lower courts finding evidence, what I consider pretty strong evidence of discriminatory intent. But the Supreme Court's already been a block, and it's only going to get worse. And so there's going to have to be, regardless of your political orientation, it's pretty obvious, it's going to have to be a lot of rethinking on the Democratic side of how they approach the court in the future. And another thing this appointment could be setting up, far beyond the Trump administration, is a massive clash in the future between the next Democratic president and a court that could turn out to be not just conservative, but very hardline conservative in the pursuit of a very rigid and formal vision of the rule of law.
I think Steve is absolutely right. I mean, I think these are extremely grim times. I mean, let me engage in a bit of self-promotion that Mark Tushnet, Mark Raber, and I have co-edited a book that will be coming out either in August or September with the Oxford Press called Constitutional Democracy in Crisis? ? And it consists of 38 essays. Probably roughly a third or half of them are about other countries as well as the United States. And you look at what's happening to the judiciary, particularly in Hungary and Poland, two countries that Trump basically has expressed admiration for, and the U.S. ambassador to Germany astoundingly has basically attacked the government of Germany for not being conservative enough and has praised the conservatives in Europe. And by conservatives, he's not talking about Charles de Gaulle or the British Tories. He's talking about Viktor Orban in Hungary and the leader of the Polish, basically neo-fascist party. And, you know, in fact, the European Union right now is trying to decide whether to strip Poland of its vote because of its basic attacks on the rule of law. I mean, I agree with John that if Trump defies a subpoena, then courts might resist. But what we're really talking about is a form of court packing. And that's what is happening particularly in Poland. And that is what the movement that Steve adverted to is out to do. And it's perfectly constitutional, but it will transform the judiciary, I think, in very ominous ways.
John Vile?
I don't have the depth of comparative knowledge, unfortunately, that Sandy has on this. But, you know, one of the trends, which is not necessarily a judicial trend, but one of the sort of the storm clouds that you see in the Trump administration is he seems to have a proclivity for praising the kind of people that traditionally we kept at arm's length. You know, even during the hottest, you know, coldest part, I guess I should say, of the Cold War, we sometimes sided with dictators, but we didn't tend to praise, you know, we didn't tend to praise the Putins of the world and the, you know, the North Korean leaders and the xenophobes and the racists. And that's very disturbing, quite apart from the court. If I can say one thing about the voting rights, probably the most consequential, or among the most consequential cases of this term were the cases dealing with gerrymandering. And I do think that this is, I think that the problems of gerrymandering are much more difficult for judges to resolve in a way that doesn't, you know, sort of start you back from scratch and often comes a little bit late to be able to do it in time for an election than some of the other problems. So I guess I'm not as down on the court for some of those decisions as maybe some of the others.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you for joining us again here on the Scholar Circle. Sandy Levinson, John Vile, and Steve Griffin. Great pleasure hosting you. Thank you so much for your time and your wisdom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tune in next week when we explore further into what Anthony Kennedy's retirement really means and if the design of the Supreme Court and the Constitution itself needs rethinking. Stephen Griffin is a professor of constitutional law at Tulane University. He's the author of American Constitutionalism, From Theory to Politics, Long Wars and the Constitution and Broken Trust, Dysfunctional Government and Constitutional Reform. Sanford Levinson is a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas. He is the author of The Undemocratic Constitution and Nullification and Secession in Modern Constitutional Thought and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. John Vile is a dean and a professor of political science at the Middle Tennessee State University. He is the author of Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, Essential Supreme Court Decisions, and The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.